Your North Carolina Reading Service provides this program for our blind and print-impaired listeners. It's the Indie Week, read by John Federson. And this issue is dated April the 20th of 2022. As we ordinarily do, we are going to mix our show today between April the 20th print edition and the online edition at indieweek.com, which has a couple of articles dateline later than the print edition came out. The first involves the elections coming up, and this in particular, the election for Wake County Sheriff. And Jasmine Gallup has written this article about it. 10 candidates. When there are 10 candidates in a political race, you know something is wrong. It's only when people are clamoring for change, a shift in policy or leadership, that 10 people throw their hats in the ring. The Wake County Sheriff's Office has been in flux for the last several years, ever since Democrat Gerald Baker was elected in 2018. Baker, then an underdog who raised just $15,000 in donations, upset Republican Sheriff Donnie Harrison, who had held the office since 2002. Harrison's policies during his 16 years as sheriff were a mix of moderate and conservative. He called for bail reform and pretrial release programs, but also proposed the creation of an independent police force for Wake County schools and began cooperating with ICE to deport immigrants. His participation in the 287G program became a flashpoint during the 2018 campaign season, as liberals accused him of pushing then-President Trump's anti-immigration agenda. Baker, a deputy at the time, pledged to end the county's cooperation with ICE and improve relationships with heavily policed communities. He took the election with a solid margin of about 10%, joining the wave of local Democrats who won races during the midterms. Since then, however, Baker has faced significant criticism. In 2020, hundreds of people gathered downtown to protest the deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and the many other black men and women killed by police. They were met with tear gas and less lethal bullets fired by Raleigh police officers and Wake County deputies. Dawn Blagrove, executive director of Emancipate NC, a nonprofit aimed at ending mass incarceration and dismantling structural racism, has this to say. We want to see a sheriff who is committed to upholding folks' constitutional rights to assemble and to protest without the fear of facing chemical weapons. Blagrove and other advocates are unhappy with the pace of change since the Black Lives Matter movement resurged in 2020. Although Baker has done a commendable job of ending cooperation with ICE, ending over-policing in Southeast Raleigh, and changing the culture inside the sheriff's office, he's not the, quote, pillar of progressive policing reform people hope for, says Blagrove. Quote, the elected officials of Wake County are definitely on some kind of time delay. They're not in tune with the needs of their constituency, and I think they're not responding rapidly enough to demands for change. We know strong and sweeping changes are possible. We've seen really progressive policies being implemented all over the country, and we have seen positive outcomes from those changes. Now, the remainder of the introductory part of this article goes on along the same lines about the progressives who wish to have something a little bit more liberal in the sheriff's office. But I'm going to skip ahead now to these report cards, so to speak, on all of the candidates who are now in this race. Besides Baker himself, there are 6 Democrats and 3 Republicans who have put themselves up on the ballot. And so the Indie Week has written a couple of paragraphs on each one, and here we go with those. First, Gerald Baker. Baker's platform has remained unchanged since his election. If reelected, he plans to continue his work, restoring the integrity of the office, he says. Baker points to his reorganization of the agency as a success and says he and his employees have answered the call to address the COVID crisis and civil unrest. Baker's hiring and firing policies have caused some controversy, however. The sheriff got into hot water this year when it was reported that he faced four lawsuits from five different employees. One suit in which former longtime deputy and chief of operations Richard Johnson alleged wrongful termination was settled for $99,999 last week. Three other people alleged discrimination and retaliation. Baker says the Johnson lawsuit was frivolous and other allegations are purely political. In a report from the News and Observer, Baker said the lawsuits he's facing are from people who would not accept the new leadership and expected to continue problematic practices that existed under the previous administration. During a conversation with Indy, Baker dropped a lot of buzzwords: transparency, diversity, accountability. But some may question whether his efforts to prioritize those principles have resulted in real change. In talking about changes he has made, Baker cited his creation of a community relations unit, the seizure of 40 million grams of drugs in the past 3 years, and increased patrol of lakes and waterways. And he says, being accountable for your staff, training, policy, setting expectations, it starts at the top. I did that immediately when I walked in. We are accountable for who we are and what we do. The next Democratic candidate, Randolph Beatty, is 46 years old. Beatty, like the five other Democratic candidates, is a political outsider with years of law enforcement experience. He currently works as a police officer with the Clayton Police Department in Johnston County, continuing a 22-year career in policing. Beatty says one of his top priorities is community engagement. That's a major talking point among all candidates in the race. Beatty plans to build trust between law enforcement and citizens with a quarterly meeting between sheriff, police chiefs, and residents. He says, people don't want to fear police intimidation, excessive force, brutality. In order to bridge those gaps, we got to have not only communication, but you got to have leadership in the community. The sheriff needs to be available and visible. Bailey also wants to enact a duty to intervene policy, which means that if an officer on the scene sees another officer engaging in misconduct, they have a duty to do something. When officers do egregious things, they shouldn't be given the opportunity to resign and move to a different department, says Beatty. My vision is to bring resources to the community. I want to bring in a human trafficking task force. I want to implement a Citizens Academy program so citizens can be part of law enforcement, so we can learn from each other. Next candidate, Joe Coley, a 51-year-old sergeant with the State Capitol Police, which guards government buildings. Like other candidates, he's hit on some of the biggest issues currently facing the sheriff's office, namely understaffing. Quote, the first major thing that's got to be done is we got to get more deputies and more detention officers. This was in an interview with WRAL. Quote, right now the jail's working on emergency staffing. That makes it unsafe for the people who are incarcerated there. Definitely makes it unsafe for the officers. Coley says he wants to make the county safe again by hiring more officers and lessening call response times. His plan for community involvement revolves around historically successful programs like Senior Well Check and Citizens Academy. Ultimately, Coley is a solid candidate, but he's mostly running on issues that are widely accepted as necessary to the continued survival of the sheriff's office. His talking points don't include some of the progressive reforms activists are pushing for. Next, Cedric Herring, 53, a retired sergeant of State Highway Patrol, has an audible passion for social justice. He speaks ardently about the need for sweeping change in the sheriff's office, including ending over-policing, releasing body camera footage, reallocating money from guns to de-escalation training. Herring says change starts with recognizing the current culture of policing that, quote, black and brown people are treated a certain way. today's police culture rewards making arrests, even if it's for low-level offenses like vagrancy, says Herring. He plans to meet with police chiefs to talk about why officers are taking so many people to jail for low-level crimes. Next, he wants to talk to the magistrate about releasing people on a promise to appear instead of a $500 bond that they can't pay. Quote, if everyone is on board where we're trying to go with this, then we can have true police reform. But it won't happen until you've got a sheriff that's in agreement that there is a true issue with the way officers have been conducting themselves out here. Herring's first priority, if elected, is to recruit and retain more officers, he said. Like other candidates, he notes the current lack of patrol and detention staff creates a public safety issue. When Herring worked for the sheriff's office in the early 2000s, there were about 20 or 25 cars on the road to patrol 500,000 people, he says. Today there are 8 cars on the road patrolling 1.2 million people. Herring is determined to implement reform, but is it enough? Although he has plenty of on-the-ground law enforcement experience, he lacks political experience that may enable him to hit the ground running. Herring says that he will be a, quote, working sheriff, getting out into the community and leading by example. And he says the sheriff's office is struggling right now because they have no structure. No one knows what the other person is supposed to be doing, so no one's doing anything. Walking in the door, that is one of the first things we have to do. Next candidate is 68-year-old Tommy Matthews. He spent about 25 years in the investigations department of the sheriff's office and first retired in 2004 as a major. He then went on to serve under Republican Sheriff Harrison as the assistant director of detention services, working to improve medical and mental health care for people who are incarcerated. He has a good record on improving the conditions in the detention center, including training staff on federal labor standards, sexual harassment, and the use of personal protective equipment. He's also talked about increasing transparency and improving the relationship between Wake County schools and school resource officers. But his platform doesn't revolve around progressive police reform. Rather, he stands on issues widely supported by the majority of people, improving mental health care, improving community engagement, and reducing officer turnover rate. Next, we have Willie Rowe, 62 years of age, yet another former law enforcement officer aiming to take the top job in the county, has a little more management experience than some of the other candidates. During his 28 years at the sheriff's office, he helped develop policy, manage the budget, and supervise staff and daily operations, he says. He's also deeply embedded in the community he hopes to serve. He's a deacon at First Baptist Church, where he has worked to increase affordable housing, reduce homelessness, and reach out to at-risk youth. If elected, Rowe plans to hold weekly meetings with community members, he says. Quote, the purpose of those meetings is for me to listen and learn, to hear concerns and gather the input of the community. We need to establish open and honest communication so the community and law enforcement can work together to prevent crime and create opportunity. This way, people don't feel like they have to resort to crime as a means of survival or acceptance. Rowe has a somewhat old-school approach to policing. When people vote for him, they will get proven leadership, proven experience, and proven relationships, he says. On reform, Rowe says the sheriff's office needs to ensure it has a qualified, diverse, and inclusive workforce. He also supports a pre-trial release program and increased education opportunities for people in jail. We can't arrest our way out, he says. It's really a matter of prevention, deterrence using education, awareness, and engagement. Next, Roy Taylor, 59 years old, also a former employee of the Wake County Sheriff's Office, brings some more diverse experience to the table. In addition to spending 40 years in law enforcement, including serving as chief of police for several agencies, Taylor is a military veteran whose jobs included inspecting prisoner of war camps and managing disciplinary barracks. in that role, Taylor had to ensure that the constitutional rights of imprisoned people were upheld, he says. If elected, one of his priorities is to improve conditions for people in the detention centers. Taylor plans to restart education programs, counseling programs, clergy visits, and substance abuse support groups in the jail. Quote, with 1,500 people, you've got to house them, clothe them, you have to feed them, and care for them. That means you have to be cognizant of their religious beliefs, their dietary needs, medical needs, psychiatric needs, and dental needs. Taylor also has a doctorate in criminal justice from Walden University and works as an expert witness. Having testified in cases where police officers shot and killed people, he's a strong advocate of providing de-escalation training, demilitarizing the police, and teaching officers how to deal with people with mental illness. And he says, one of the things that happened to our country after 9/11 was that police officers were trained to be warriors and not guardians. Warriors occupy territory. We go in as soldiers, take over a piece of ground, and control it. Well, that's not the job of law enforcement. Our job is to protect the community residents from harm. Now, that concludes the Democratic candidates listed. And who are the Republican candidates? Well, there's Donnie Harrison, age 76. Despite calls for change, Harrison's vision for the sheriff's office hasn't changed much. Not necessarily a bad strategy, given that his former policies won him more than a decade in the seat. If reelected, Harrison seems likely to reinstate that controversial 287G program, resuming cooperation with ICE. He stood by previous statements that the program helps keep immigrant communities safe, saying it keeps people who are wanted for crimes off the streets. Harrison says he will support the program, quote, if I think it can make this county safer for the Hispanic community or for anybody in this community. Harrison also plans to continue investment in mental health training and community engagement, he says. He cited his open door policy as evidence he was available and willing to talk to residents. Like other candidates, recruitment and retention of officers is a priority for Harrison. He criticized the current administration, saying his experience will help him hit the ground running and reunite the agency. Quote, so many people don't understand what law enforcement officers do. Even the news media don't understand how quickly we have to make decisions involving our life and other people's lives. So we got to educate the public. One thing I probably said millions of times to my deputies, put God first, your family, job, and treat people like you want to be treated. The next Republican candidate, David Blackwelder, 36 years of age. Harrison's defeat in 2018 has drawn other Republican candidates out, hoping to usher in a new era of leadership. Blackwelder, an attorney who works in antitrust law, presents a more liberal alternative to Harrison. The former police officer has a checkered background, however. He was arrested in October for driving while intoxicated, a charge that was ultimately dismissed due to lack of witnesses. He's been a strong critic of Baker's administration, saying if elected, he will remove the sheriff's right to hire and fire based on political affiliation. Blackwelder worked as a police officer for 10 years before becoming disenchanted with the profession, he says. As sheriff, he thinks he can make a bigger difference in changing internal policies and ultimately rebuilding trust between law enforcement and the public. If elected, he says he plans to empower people in their interactions with police by educating them about their constitutional rights. He wants to start using consent forms for police searches to ensure people know what they're agreeing to. He also supports the legalization of marijuana, he says. Finally, Tavon Howard, 46 years of age, an officer with the Zebulon Police Department, has a platform almost identical to that of other candidates. Like some of his opponents, he supports mental health and de-escalation training for officers. He wants to address the opioid epidemic and engage the public with a Wake Citizen Corps program. I'm here for the community, he says. I'm willing to listen. Howard prioritizes transparency and wants to create a civilian board to oversee the promotion process, he says. He also has some ideas for improving officer morale, annual cost of living increases, for one, and reducing recidivism through education and community service. Overall, however, there's nothing eye-catching about his platform, and although he does have on-the-ground experience, some may question whether he's ready to take charge of the sheriff's office. I'll return now briefly to Jasmine Gallup's some of other comments. And first of all, there is a graph included in here, which you can't look at, but I can describe it to you. It's candidates' recent campaign spending for sheriff. It includes money spent on the campaign and how much of it was their own money. And by far, the recent campaign spending for Donnie Harrison, Republican, and Roy Taylor, the Democrat, are $120,000 or more. And in the case of Mr. Taylor, his own money is over $100,000 spent towards his campaign. The others are well below the $30,000 mark. And then finally, Jasmine Gallup writes, who's likely to win? There are 7 Democrats and 3 Republicans. With such a crowded field, name recognition may end up counting for a lot. In that arena, Baker and Harrison have the advantage. Next month's primary will whittle those numbers of candidates down to just 2, one Democrat, one Republican, who will ultimately face off in November's general election. All right, and let's stay on election-related news. And this article by Tomasi McDonald from Durham, Stealth Slate. Last month, the Durham-based partisan science data firm EQV Analytics published a report entitled, Can the GOP Take Over Blue Durham's County's Board of Education? They're betting on it. Days later, indie staffers began receiving emails expressing alarm about what's being referred to as the Better Board, Better Schools, Better Futures, BBBS, the slate of school board candidates. Megan Lyon wrote in an email that she and her husband reached out to District 3 school board candidate Gayathri Rajaraman to learn more about her platform. Lyon says, her answers alarmed me. Lyon and her husband aren't the only Durham residents alarmed at the prospect of the BBBS so-called stealth slate capturing seats on the county school board. Rebecca Bramlett wrote in an email, I worry that many Durham residents may think we are immune to these extreme conservative challenges to our board since we are used to being in our blue Durham bubble. But it's not the case, and I hope people are paying attention. Not one of Durham's 3 most influential political action committees has endorsed any of the 5 GOP candidates who are running for seats on the county board, including the nonpartisan Friends of Durham, FOD, PAC, Political Action Committee. Durham attorney and PAC co-chair Patrick Biker told the Indy this week, we interviewed all of the BBBS candidates and chose not to endorse them. He said a combination of factors dissuaded the FOD from endorsing the GOP candidates. First and foremost, the slate finds it easy enough to play armchair quarterback and fling a barrage of criticisms about the school board and Durham Public Schools policies, but offers next to nothing by way of problem solving. And he says, we really expect candidates to have solutions for the problems they identify. It's easy to complain about a problem. It's difficult to put forth sound thinking about how we, as a community, can support our superintendent and students, and then identify and implement cost-effective solutions. There are also questions in the community about the ethics of the campaigning of BBBS and whether they are abiding by the rules. This week, Paula Januzzi-Godfrey, a Glenn Elementary school librarian and 2020 school board candidate, told the Indy she received a text Monday morning from a teacher at Merrick Moore Elementary. That teacher had requested donations of copy paper on her neighborhood listserv and received some reams of paper at the school with stickers of the BBBS candidates' faces. Genesee Godfrey told the Indy in an email, quote, "When I was running for school board, it was made clear I was not allowed to campaign, wear a button or sticker for my campaign on school premises, and no other teachers could either." Based on some of the candidates' social media posts, the BBBS slate might be best described with the letter Q followed by A-N-O-N. Consider that Joetta McMiller, who is campaigning for Consolidated District B, announced in January 5th of 2021 on social media that she had, quote, "arrived in D.C. at the Stop the Steal rally that morphed into violence at the U.S. Capitol, where a mob thought it apt to attack police officers and smear feces on the walls. It is going to be wild," wrote McMiller, echoing the words of the January 6th insurrection's chief instigator, Donald Trump. One day later, McMiller announced, "My group got tear gassed, but we are safe and on our way home to North Carolina." McMiller could not be reached for comment. In late January, McMiller and Proud Boy member John Fisher, who is running for a seat on the Johnston County School Board, were among the attendees of a statewide education forum held by the far-right groups Education First NC, Moms for Liberty, and No Left Turn in Education. No Left Turn describes itself as, quote, "a movement to combat racial indoctrination in our K-12 education system." District 1 candidate Curtis Reshuck is a Canadian immigrant who registered to vote for the first time in December. In an email to Indy, he derided a description of him by EQV Analytics as, quote, "an evangelical Catholic who," quote, "reveals himself on Facebook to be an anti-Semitic, climate-denying, anti-vax creationist in favor of starving local governments, including our public schools, of revenue." Raisha told the Indy that he views EQVAnalytics.com as a satire or humor site, and they aren't worth my attention. An indie review of his Facebook page shows that on August 30, 2016, he posted a Breitbart story about George Soros, quote, "manipulating government for his own very sick agenda." The Breitbart story claims that Soros was an unseen participant in efforts to reform law enforcement agencies after black people across the country died at the hands of the police. Quote of the day, Reshuck posted in 2016 on his Facebook page, "People can and should do everything they can to pay as little in taxes as possible." Valerie Jarvis is a school board District 4 candidate and GOP Durham County Precinct Chair who is married to Emmanuel Jarvis, the county's GOP chair, who declared in a 2020 podcast that being a black Trumpist is akin to being a, quote, "homosexual black man in the 70s in a southern state." Regarding black voters, he said, quote, "if they had a cardboard box running for president, 85% of the African-American community would vote for the box." Emmanuel Jarvis, during that podcast, said he agreed with Trump's claim that he has done more for black Americans than Abraham Lincoln. "That's pretty close," Jarvis said, offering as an example his daughter being the recipient of a financial grant owing to a bill that the former president signed into law. Jarvis said it was imperative that black Americans move from poverty to prosperity. The other two candidates are Christopher Burns, vying for the District 2 seat, who EVQ Analytics report is an independent contractor, quote, with zero employees and who, quote, pocketed over $30,000 in subsequently forgiven Paycheck Protection Program loans in 2020 and 2021. And Raja Raman, who announced that she's running for the school board at the behest of Emmanuel Jarvis. Raja Raman, like Burns, has a scant social media presence, but told the Indy she doesn't think younger students should learn about topics like the historical racism upon which the nation was largely built. Quote, she wrote, "especially at elementary and middle school age, children's brains are still growing. They're hungry to learn. They should be taught math concepts and science at an early age like they do in countries like India. Instead, we are distracting and overwhelming them with social topics such as racism, gender identity, and political viewpoints in school classrooms. We are dumbing our kids down while other developing nations are putting focus only on math, science, arts, and STEM programs. Perhaps the short answer to Roger Rumman's concern has to do with Black Americans' lived experience in a nation that has a long history of targeting the group with racism, bigotry, and violence. Last year, GOP legislators at the General Assembly sponsored House Bill 324 that proposed to make white people feel less uncomfortable about the negative aspects of the nation's racial history. It appears no one in the GOP considered how not teaching those aspects would make black students and the black community at large feel uncomfortable. As the Indy previously reported, Durham City Council and School Board each adopted resolutions opposing HB 324, and Governor Cooper vetoed that bill on September the 10th. Last year, the website Right Wing Watch warned of a far-right, quote, campaign to stifle teaching and discussion about racism in U.S. history and institutions, with fear-mongering about critical race theory to mobilize right-wing activists and conservative voters to take over local school boards. Right-Wing Watch writer Peter Montgomery explained, critical race theory is an academic analytical framework for exploring the existence and impact of systemic racism. Over the past year, the term has been aggressively deployed as a right-wing culture war weapon that's being used to smear educators and social justice activists. School board chair Bettina Umstead, who is up for re-election in District 2, echoed Montgomery's analysis. She's saying, I'm worried that they are not prepared to do the equity work here in Durham County on behalf of black and brown students who are in our schools. The current school board is cited on a watch list by Turning Point USA, TPUSA, a conservative nonprofit that states its mission is to, quote, educate, train, and organize students to promote freedom. According to the TPUSA, the Durham School Board is, quote, actively trying to indoctrinate children with critical race theory and other hateful, divisive, and anti-American curriculum. TPUSA also asserts the school board has undergone extreme scrutiny for publicly supporting a resolution that teaches CRT to the students throughout the district. Well, that's a lie, plain and simple. School board member Natalie Beyer says, no, we do not. But we very much believe and are focused on equity, and we're not shying away from this nation's difficult history. Beyer, whom Valerie Jarvis is challenging in District 4, told Indy this week that she's never seen the BBBS candidates at a school board meeting or received an email about anything from them during her tenure on the board. She says, it's highly unusual for Durham, and they haven't been showing up. They aren't out in public, and they haven't been to any forums, except for a virtual meeting that was hosted by a community located off Leesville Road. Beyer says the slate is trafficking in fear-mongering and divisiveness. It's not about the schools, she says. A review of the GOP candidate's website, betterboardbetterschools.com, gives scant information about what the group is proposing to create a more effective learning environment in the county's public school classrooms. Their campaign promise says they, quote, will ensure that every graduating student is prepared for the workforce or college. Our students are cheated by lowering standards and curriculum deviations that do not directly aid in the competition of the worldwide marketplace. Raja Rahman and Rishuk were the only candidates to respond to the Indies question. Raja Rahman says, school exists to educate our children when asked about curriculum deviations. Her concerns run counter to the state's Board of Education strategic plan, adopted in 2019, that defined equity as a guiding principle and recently approved social studies standards, quote, to ensure that a more comprehensive, accurate, and honest history was taught to all students, including Teaching on Racism, Identity, and Discrimination. Beyer told Indy last year, "It's important for teachers to be able to teach children to think critically from primary sources. And as we are more honest about our history, we can learn from the past. We don't censor teachers. We don't ban books. We teach children to be anti-racist." The BBBS QAnon slate faces a Sisyphean task in the Bull City, where there are 233,000 registered voters, and Democrats outnumber Republicans by more than 5-1, according to the Durham County Board of Elections. However, Durham also has 81,000 unaffiliated voters, along with 1,200 libertarian voters. With a historically lower voter turnout for primary elections, the EQV Analytics report says, the BBBS slate is a highly organized campaign conceived, organized, launched, and supported by the Durham County GOP in hopes of slipping a block of Republicans under the voters' radar to take control of the school board of one of the most heavily Democratic counties in the state. When the Indy asked what specific policies or measures the slate would implement to improve the academic performance of DPS students, Hrishik began by stating that the current school board is failing in its main mission, education. "In my district, 4 out of 5 students are not ready to move to the next grade," he wrote in an email. "That's 80% of students not ready for the next grade." Michelle Burton, president of the Durham Association of Educators, which did not endorse the BBBS slate, told Indy Hrishik and his fellow GOP candidates are focusing on end-of-grade test scores that do not take into account a student's classroom performance or their total portfolio of academic performance. "What's never mentioned," says Burton, "is funding of the public schools adequately." She notes the BBBS slate is not speaking in support of the Leandro case that's been hamstrung for decades by the state's GOP legislators and that would give public schools $1.7 billion. "No one is talking about that," she says. Last month, the state Supreme Court agreed to hear that case after GOP State Controller Linda Combs asked the North Carolina Court of Appeals to throw out Wake County Superior Court Judge David Lee's November 10th order, requiring her to fund that $1.7 billion plan to fully support public schools. Burton thinks the mission of BBBS slate is, quote, "to alarm and scare people and get us off focus on what's really needed, and that is funding our schools adequately." But can the BBBS slate win seats on the Durham County School Board? William Busa, the director of EQV Analytics, thinks so. He wrote in last month's online report, quote, "Even here in deep blue Durham, it's not impossible that these 5 radical Republicans might just succeed in wrestling control of the school board away from Democrats, thanks to meticulous planning, sophisticated organization, a stacked deck of election law, and most importantly, a flurry of industrial-strength deception." Busa says part of the deception that the slate is relying on is a state law that mandates that county school board members shall be elected on a nonpartisan basis. That is, Busa wrote, without limiting candidates to a single nominee from each party, and without listing candidates' party affiliations on the ballot, and that school board elections shall be held during the state's primary election rather than the November general election. Busa notes that even more insidiously, the state's Republican-controlled legislature has been, quote, "selectively chipping away at this nonpartisan status for partisan advantage by passing special local laws that make selected Republican-heavy counties' school board elections partisan while leaving Democrat-heavy counties' elections nonpartisan, with the effect of promoting Republican control in GOP-heavy counties while enabling potential stealth Republican inroads into Democratic counties." Busa wrote, "Durham thus remains a nonpartisan school board with its election on primary day and its 5 Republican candidates campaigning together under the brand name BBBS are taking every advantage of this cloaking device. Last week, Bousset told Indy that he has worked with several political campaigns in the past and typically looks up the party affiliations of candidates campaigning in nonpartisan races. "That's an oxymoron," he said late last week. "They're all partisan." He says he became interested in Durham's school board races when he noticed that registered Republican candidates had filed to run in each of the five seats, and they all shared the same campaign address of their joint campaign treasurer. Quote, "The $1 million home of a county GOP precinct chair, see Donald Stanger." He explains they were all recruited by Emmanuel Jarvis. It became very clear they were working in concert to pull a fast one on Durham County and take control of the school board. Bousset says what's happening in Durham is part of a nationwide attempt by, quote, Republican fascists to take over school board, and Burton agrees. "We're seeing it all over the state, all over the country, with even more and more due to the pandemic and schools reopening," she says. "In my assessment, they need to do the research to understand what's really going on in education." All right, away from elections per se, and over to IndyWeek.com for an article that was entered later than the printed version that I'm reading. This is Durham's Harriet Tubman, YWCA will be renovated for affordable housing. On Monday, Durham community members accepted a $1 million grant from the Department of Housing and Urban Development to restore and renovate that historic location at 312 Umstead Street, near the High Tea District, just south of downtown, into affordable housing. The center will be renovated by Reinvestment Partners, a Durham nonprofit that seeks to revitalize locations with a focus on positively impacting communities and combating social inequities. According to the group, the Harriet Tubman Building was first built in 1953. It originally contained 12 women's dorms that housed black student nurses and was a community hub for events and organizing, especially during the civil rights movement. Yet the center ceased operations in the 1970s and has been fully inactive for 30 years. The executive director of Reinvestment Partners, Peter Skillern, told ABC News 11 that the renovation will include 6 studio apartments, alongside a congregate area that will include offices, computers, and a kitchen. The units will be rented specifically to those making 30 to 60% or less of the area median income, and at least 4 units will be allocated to individuals who have formerly experienced homeless or come from other special needs groups. And Skillern said, "We'll be able to provide both services and housing here. That's building back better." Despite its historical significance, the building was nearly demolished in 2018 following concerns over unsafe building conditions and reports of illegal activity on the property. When the community voiced concerns over its historical significance, the demolition was put on hold and, in 2019, Reinvestment Partners purchased the building. Skillern said renovation will seek to keep the building as historically preserved as possible. The renovation is expected to take approximately 18 months. Mayor Elaine O'Neill, in an interview with that station, ABC 11, recounted spending time at the center growing up and expressed excitement for its new purpose. Quote, "Thanks for bringing back a part of my life back alive and for all of those young people and all of the memories that were made. We want them to now have a chance of a new generation of memories like I did. And they too can grow up and be mayor." And Mayor McNeil was present to give an address, the State of the City address, just recently. And she encouraged city and county residents to volunteer with the city's boards, commissions, and community-based organizations on behalf of a city in crisis, still recovering from a pandemic and unprecedented gun violence. While delivering her first State of the City 3 months after being sworn in, she said it's also past time to rebuild the High Tea District. the historically black residential and economic hub destroyed more than half a century ago by the federal urban renewal program. And she said, quote, I'm struck by the fact there are two main streets in Durham. Yes, on one end of Main Street, you see high-rises, shops, and the amenities that illustrate the leaps towards prosperity that many in Durham have experienced over the last few years. On the other end of Main Street, you see a community that has not kept up with the prosperity. Main Street runs through the heart of Durham. The time has come to stitch the quilt and make Durham equitable for all. And for all of Durham to share in the prosperity, she described a rebalancing that takes into account neighborhoods negatively impacted by urban renewal and decades of neglect. The black community, and thus Durham, has never recovered from the loss of the 150 businesses in Haiti. And she announced the city is supporting a partnership between Haiti Heritage Foundation and the Urban Land Institute on a mission to explore the redevelopment of the Fayetteville Street corridor, saying it will have a community-centered mindset, ensuring the community is involved in both planning and economic participation. The mayor did not say if the community-centered mindset would include input or participation of officials with Haiti Reborn, the Durham developers who asked the city council for a public hearing after their proposal to develop a residential, economic, and educational hub at Fayette Place in the Haiti neighborhood was not selected by the Durham Housing Authority. Haiti will come back, Neil said. We want prosperity in every corner of Durham. In addition to shared prosperity, she talked about creating safer neighborhoods, affordable housing, infrastructure, public health, the pandemic, and the importance of being an inclusive and welcoming city. She told city residents that 21 people have applied for the council seat, left vacant when Charlie Reese resigned last month to move to Paris with his family. Holding public office is serious business, she said, and I'm grateful that we will have a strong pool of candidates from which to select. We intend to choose an applicant who will represent the interest of all Durham residents. In her estimation, a better Durham starts with creating a safe city and safe neighborhoods for all. Quote, our city is in a crisis, and gun violence is taking the lives of far too many of our residents and our young black males. Over these past few months since I've taken office, the gun violence has marched toward seemingly new levels of violence and chaos. Just this past week, we have seen 6 deaths. I also want to recognize the citywide trauma that our residents are feeling. We are a city in pain, and we are struggling to make sense of the violence we continue to witness. In advancing the cause of citywide volunteerism to help Bull City heal from gun violence, grow, and become stronger, the mayor pointed to a question Martin Luther King Jr. asked in 1957. Life's most persistent and urgent question is, what are you doing for others? She suggested find any local organization, especially where our youth are involved. Zoom has provided a great way to read to a class, offer a tour of a local museum through a video, and volunteer to exist at a school an hour or two each week, food pantries, school supply drives, neighborhood cleanup and beautification, coding brigades, libraries, literacy, and youth organization, gun violence prevention groups. The list goes on. Bring a friend or two and grow the network that we need. The mayor shared a bundle of high points, including a partnership between the city, county, and Duke University to make available loans to small businesses that have been affected by the pandemic. That initiative, known as the Opportunity Loan Fund, has disbursed $860,000 in funds to 39 businesses, with 29 of them owned by people of color or women. And quote, there are $140,000 of city funds and $800,000 of county funds remaining in this opportunity fund to provide low-cost financing via loans of $5,000 to $35,000 to eligible businesses. The city's first black woman mayor also touted the more than $50 million the city is set to receive from the Federal American Rescue Plan that will be used to offset revenue losses as a consequence of the pandemic. Quote, these funds can be used to address other community needs, she said. She praised the Youth Works program. Her 1,500 young people between the ages of 14 and 24 have applied to participate in a summer program that, quote, allows our young people to develop critical skills and explore career opportunities through paid summer internships. She added that the number of interest applications the program received are the largest in recent history. I want to again call everyone's attention to Indie Week's cultural calendars that are quite up to date online, indieweek.com. These are kept current by day. So I'm reading this article today, Friday afternoon, and events that were taking place yesterday are not in the calendar anymore. So by going there to indieweek.com and looking for events calendar, you'll see things from all of the main towns and cities around the Triangle area. Anyway, music, film, instruction, hikes, things that anybody can, you can certainly pick out one or two things that you can get to that are accessible, let's put it that way. And so I'm not going to be reading very many of these anymore like I had been a little while ago. It's just because they fall out of timeliness so quickly. But they are available at this website, which is IndieWeek, IndyWeek, IndieWeek.com. And I believe I will read one column, a question and answer, from Art Column by Brian Howe, which describes the floating world. That is Sto Len, an artist who is usually based in Queens. Usually, he picks up his own trash and lots of other people's too. You'd expect no less from the New York Department of Sanitation's official artist in residence, who uses traditional Japanese techniques like suminigashi, or floating ink, and gyotaku, fish impression, to catalog the flotsam he trawls from waterways in ecologically damning, strangely beautiful prints. But his residency at Level Retreat in Chapel Hill was short enough that he needed folks to wade in for him. Luckily, a Haw River Assembly River cleanup was perfectly timed to deliver 10 bags full of goodies, like Christmas, he says, just as he arrived. While the prints he made and some of the goodies are on view now at Peel Gallery, P-E-E-L Gallery in Carrboro, we spoke with Sto Len about his fascinating day job, journey into Japanese printmaking, and his deepening collaboration with the water. What have you done as a New York Sanitation Department's artist in residence? First, he says, I spend a lot of time interviewing and hanging out with workers and following the waste trail from the household curb to collection truck, waste transfer stations in all five boroughs. From there, the trash gets put on barges that go down the Hudson or East River to New Jersey, or it gets put on trains to landfills in Virginia or upstate New York. I wanted a studio, so they took me to this place called Central Repair Shop, which is the size of the Empire State Building if it were horizontal. Everything's broken in New York goes there, from truck to upholstery projects. They put me in an old silk screen studio that hadn't been used in 20 years, and I'm doing mashups of their old designs with my own. That's been really fun to do around the workers who come in and go, oh my God, I remember that. In the same building, there's an old TV studio, and I'm working with the last guy who worked there to digitize this incredible film and video collection they have, dating back to the 1930s. I'm making video art with it, and I'm working on a television show that should have some episodes out by the fall. An artist residency at the sanitation department sounds like something an artist came up with, not the city. You're absolutely right. In the 1970s, Muriel Lederman-Ukelis wrote to the commissioner and said, Hi, I'm really interested in sanitation and maintenance and being an artist in residence. And luckily, that commissioner said yes. It was an unsalaried, unfunded position that she turned into a career for 40 years. She's in her 80s now, and I've hung out with her. She's amazing. How did you get into the Japanese printmaking techniques that you use? I did a show in Japan in 2009, and I fell in love with calligraphy. Coming back to New York and continuing to play with Sumi ink, I realized that it floated. I thought I had invented something amazing because you could make a floating painting, and if you put paper down, you could actually print from the surface of the water. Then I discovered that Shinto monks had been doing this since the 12th century. I got really into suminagashi, the floating ink printmaking process. Shinto is an animistic religion, so the act of printmaking with water was this connecting of spirits. A non-hierarchical way of thinking about things like water and land and animals. You can't control water. You have to collaborate with it, and that began opening up my ideas for collaborating with nature and situations. It taught me to be more fluid and adaptive in my art process. It's funny, because we basically live on a series of islands in New York, but it's not island life at all, and people don't generally think about the waters. The waterways are often some of the least populated areas, and I was always finding these cool pockets to hang out in. In doing that, I was learning about the industrial histories and pollution of these waterways, and I realized that they were like the floating paintings I was printing in the studio. I had a eureka moment. I started going around New York City with paper, printing the surfaces of the water, which were often combined with sewage overflow and other detritus, but came out really beautiful. I realized my studio could be a boat or the waterways. In New York, people would say, I didn't even know that was there. So it's a place-making process that also brings awareness to issues like combined sewage overflow. Well, I must wrap up this podcast of the Indie Week. Now for the North Carolina Reading Service, ncreadingservice.org. It's John Federson bidding you farewell, and come join us for our next issue of Indie Week.